Our collective nightmare it is 2026. Donald Trump was re-elected in 2024, and now the White House looks at a map the way a kid looks at a candy store window. The candy is Greenland. The kid has a military parade and a history of throwing fits that end in chaos. Allies are trying to act like grown-ups. Denmark's prime minister said it plainly on TV. Greenland doesn't want to be part of the United States. She warned that if the US attacks a NATO partner, the alliance stops. That's not a threat. It's a promise. NATO is not a sacred thing you can poke and expect to keep working. It's a pact. Poke it long enough and it snaps. The President of the United States said out loud that the country needs Greenland for national security and accused Denmark of being unable to hold it. An administration aide posted a picture of Greenland with an American flag over it and wrote, "Soon, that is the level of public planning we're watching." Maps, memes, and military muscle flexed as if policy were an Instagram stunt. Just months after an extraordinary raid in Venezuela that the administration calls a success, leaders in Copenhagen staged drills and sent jets and ships to Greenland. They want to show they mean business without saying, "We will shoot back." They also insist, privately and awkwardly, that there is no real military threat to Greenland right now from Russia or China. The island is huge, cold, and mostly inaccessible. It is not an obvious prize unless you think conquest is a hobby. The weird part is simple. The cost isn't whether you can take Greenland. The cost is whether taking it means cutting off the one thing that used to make an American threat tolerable, the expectation that we still honor alliances. If the United States attacks a NATO territory, Denmark says the alliance dissolves. That's a very practical domino. It's not theory, it's divorce papers landing on a table. Watch the language. Strategic, national security, covered with Russian and Chinese ships, those words are tidy excuses. They make imperial appetite sound like necessity. Meanwhile, military officers who live in the Arctic say the island is hard to attack and harder to hold. The land itself is a defense. Weather and geography will do most of the fighting for Denmark. What frightens Europe isn't glaciers or ships, it's humiliation. A longtime partner being publicly courted for annexation by the man who already ordered an unpredictable raid in Venezuela. The humiliation will be the slow poison. Allies will start whispering to each other, recalculating trust. Military cooperation phrase when leaders don't trust the handshake across the table. This looks less like geostrategy and more like a temper tantrum with aircraft carriers. There is no grand plan on display, just raw appetite, posture, and tweets that double as threats. When the state behaves like a bully with the nuclear codes, the rest of the world learns two things. You can be unpredictable, and you can be impolite. Both are contagious. Call it what it is. A test of whether the post-World War II order is durable or merely a set of polite agreements waiting for a government tired of politeness. If an ally can be bullied into silence, alliances will become transactional and brittle. That will not keep anyone safer. So Greenland stays big and cold and mostly unconquerable. Maps can be colored any way you want on a screen. Reality has glacier time. But politics moves faster than ice. The risk isn't a physical occupation, it's the slow unspooling of trust. The United States, re-elected and restless, is practicing a form of foreign policy that treats partners like accessories and alliances like negotiable options. We watch the flag overlays and the Air Force One quotes as if they were weather reports. They are not. They are intent. The rest of the world is writing contingency plans while America acts like a child pointing at a toy it doesn't own. This will leave alliances bruised, Greenland annoyed and armed with geography, and the idea of America as a steady ally looking more like a fading postcard. It is not heroic, it is not clever. It is a tantrum that could hollow out the one structure that once made global power less chaotic. The island will be fine in its cold. The rest of us will be left with the thaw.
NVIDIA unveiled Vera Rubin at CES, which sounds like a spaceship but is actually a server rack that the company says provides more bandwidth than the entire internet. That line reads like a humble brag from a bully. Congratulations, you're now more powerful than the thing everyone uses to watch cat videos. Jensen Huang walked out in his leather jacket because every apocalypse needs its rock star, and demonstrated a tabletop robot that can recount your to-do list and tell the dog to get off the couch. Massive new data centers, exotic storage architectures, licensing deals, circular funding spirals, all to politely evict Fido. We went from inventing fire to building a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure so a tiny plastic assistant can handle basic house manners. Storage can no longer be an afterthought, someone said, in the tone people reserve for urgent moral crises. Translation: we spent a decade ignoring the attic, and now the attic needs its own server farm. The bottleneck isn't chips anymore, it's context. We're spending billions so machines can remember what you meant when you cursed at your calendar last Tuesday. Meanwhile, every major cloud provider is first in line to deploy this thing, like it's Disneyland for data. Companies are building their own chips because nobody wants to be beholden to Nvidia, which is the corporate version of people who refuse to rely on their one friend who always brings the good dip. The result is a lot of money moving in circles until it gets dizzy and funds a robot that knows your grocery list but not how to fix a pothole. We are constructing an empire of computation so that someday soon, your household's intelligence layer will be able to reason through a multi-step task. Open the app, find the dog, deliver a stern but empathetic command, then upsell you premium context management. Progress, apparently, is paying for a server rack the size of a refrigerator to enforce furniture etiquette.
The Department of Health and Human Services has quietly decided that American children need fewer recommended vaccines, just as flu cases surge and 9 kids have already died this season. The logic is pure modern governance. Shrink the official list, call it trust building, and insist insurance will still pay, because coverage looks reassuring even if access gets a little messier. The new schedule keeps the big hitters: measles, mumps, rubella, polio, chickenpox, HPV, but trims recommendations for meningococcal disease and hepatitis A and B, limiting them to kids deemed higher risk. Flu, COVID-19, and rotavirus move to shared clinical decision-making, which is bureaucratic code for, if you want these shots, go find a doctor and convince them. RSV guidance is unchanged, for the moment, a tiny island of normalcy in an otherwise recast map. This rearrangement didn't come out of nowhere. HHS was remade under Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime vaccine skeptic who emptied the advisory boards and installed new members. A presidential nudge from Donald Trump, who demanded a fast-track review and later praised the leaner schedule, provided the political wind. Officials waved across the pond comparisons to Denmark like a foreign flag of approval, ignoring the one inconvenient detail. Denmark treats public health very differently, with universal prenatal and pediatric care that most U.S. families do not have. The supposed benefits are political and rhetorical. Officials argue that fewer recommendations will restore faith in public health. Translation: if distrust is rising, don't fix the reasons for distrust. Adjust the product until it looks more familiar. Meanwhile, the practical result is more friction for families. Appointments, consultations, state-by-state confusion. Insurers will still cover the shots, but coverage does not replace access. It doesn't fix childcare, time off work, travel costs, or the clinics that closed in rural counties. The administrative undoing extends beyond the schedule. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has stopped requiring states to report childhood vaccination data for Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries. That tracking started only in 2024, but more than 40% of kids rely on those programs. The government is now exploring measuring how often parents hear about vaccine safety and alternatives, a pivot from objective public health metrics to polls about feelings. Expect data deserts where political winds prefer them, and pockets of robust tracking where local leaders insist on it. Diseases, inconveniently, do not respect budget lines or party platforms. Experts warn, this will invite outbreaks. They aren't being alarmists. They're reading the room. Reducing universal recommendations in a country with uneven healthcare access is not a safety measure. It's a bet that Americans will navigate a maze of consultations and state policies to get protected, and a bet that pathogens will be polite about waiting their turn. The government's message is now: we will protect you against the most dire threats, we won't mandate everything, and we'll trust parents and doctors to sort the rest out. In practice, that looks like a disassembled safety net, a political haircut passed off as public health reform, and the quiet hope that no one notices until the next outbreak starts climbing the charts.
based on an article from CNN titled, Three Keystone Habits That Can Transform Your Health in 2026 and Make Everything Easier, we are told that willpower is a flimsy engine. It roars at New Year and sputters by February. The solution, according to Dana Santis and a small army of behavioral scientists, is to outsource our survival to small, automatic rituals. 6 slow breaths before leaving the bed, a 5-minute yoga routine, a handful of squats every time you wash your hands. Humanity's grand project apparently is to train itself into being less miserable through appliance-level repetition. There's beauty and bleakness in that. On one hand, habits are honest. They don't promise cosmic meaning, only incremental change. On the other, it's oddly comforting that the pinnacle of human ingenuity might be habit stacking, gluing a new ritual to an old one so our future selves have fewer moral decisions to make. We move from heroic resolutions to quiet engineering. Change the context, lower cognitive load, let the body do the rest. It's efficiency applied to existential discomfort. Consider conscious breathing. A few long exhales tamp down the fight or flight furnace, improve posture, maybe make you nicer to yourself for 10 minutes. It doesn't solve systemic injustice, cure loneliness, or explain why anything exists. But it asks you to notice that you are a body negotiating gravity and time, and not to panic about it for a moment. That's a small victory. A little absurd, but also strangely tender. Mindful movement and mind-body practices operate the same way. They promise ripple effects, less pain, better sleep, smarter choices, without ever promising a life without unpleasantness. The irony is delicious. We train our bodies to tolerate life better. While the larger world continues being indifferent, we become more efficient at being finite. There's a philosophical angle hiding in the CNN how-to, meaning, if it appears, is often a side effect of routine. Small actions compound into identity. The habit you repeat becomes the person who repeats it. If the universe doesn't hand you meaning, maybe you can manufacture some by quietly aligning breath, posture, and attention day after day. So pick one small thing. Put your sneakers by the door like a tiny sacrament. Breathe before you scroll. Do 5 squats as if the act itself were a small protest against entropy. The revolt isn't dramatic. It's mundane and stubborn. If existential dread is a storm, Keystone habits are the umbrella you keep forgetting but finally remember to take. They won't change the weather, but they will keep you dry for long enough to notice the sky.
Citizenship has been repackaged as a consumer product. The passport, once a marker of membership and mutual obligation, is now a swipeable convenience good. Buy faster travel, buy an exit strategy, buy a quieter visa stamp. Governments auction off rights, law firms sell the paperwork, and private firms hawk insurance policies to anxious citizens who treat national belonging like a line item in a portfolio. The rich shop for mobility. George Clooney gets French citizenship as the year turns and the rest of the world tightens its gates. Henley & Partners opens offices in the United States to cash in on American buyers. Citizenship by investment becomes a familiar headline because it's cheaper to sell sovereignty than to fix the problems that made passports desirable escape routes in the first place. Democracy coughs while bureaucrats write receipts. Malta's golden passports were axed only after Brussels intervened. Other European states quietly close loopholes when the optics get bad. Italy passes an emergency decree to claw back descent-based rights, prompting a constitutional fight in March 2026. Governments flip between selling passports to raise cash and slamming the door shut when public outrage rises. The message is clear. Rights are fungible when treasuries or donors demand liquidity. The industry thrives on contradiction. Firms promise permanence while lawyers sprint to exploit temporary rules. Grab what you can, experts advise, as if heritage and legal status were limited edition sneakers. The result is a global black market of citizenship arbitrage. Investors, celebrities, exiles, and the well-connected moving across legal systems in search of convenience and safety, while the rest of us wait on the other side of an expanding inequality chasm. Hypocrisy is the business model. Politicians propose loyalty tests one day and accept the benefits of transnational ties the next. Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno floats an exclusive citizenship act, demanding sole allegiance, a stunt that would ensnare ordinary immigrants more easily than it would unseat the privileged. Meanwhile, even the family of the man who sits in the Oval Office holds more than one passport. Allegiance becomes a political cudgel aimed at the powerless. The downsides exist only for those who can't afford workarounds. military conscription, tax traps, and retroactive denials of social services land on the heads of ordinary dual nationals, while citizenship by investment buyers structure their holdings to avoid them. Countries that do tax citizens worldwide or that criminalize renunciation turn legal identity into a lifelong fetter for anyone without cash or connections. Small states sell themselves to survive. Nauru launches a climate-resilient citizenship fund and advertises visa access like a travel perk. Argentina teases $500,000 packages. El Salvador ties nationality to Bitcoin. These are not reforms. They're desperate fundraisers dressed up as nation building, turning communal obligations into microtransactional revenue streams. The rules get tighter for everyone else and looser for the people who write the checks. Spain cancels some golden visas. Portugal closes Sephardic fast tracks, and Sweden raises residency thresholds. Yet every tightened door bursts a new window for those with lawyers and wallets. When investment routes narrow, merit frameworks and ministerial favors proliferate, celebrity citizenship handed out as diplomatic patronage while the public watches. This is not migration policy, it's risk management marketed to the affluent. Second passports are sold as calm in a storm, as if a piece of laminated paper could immunize people from political collapse, climate disaster, or economic breakdown. The panic is packaged, priced, and parceled into legal advice appointments and escrow accounts. The fantasy sold to anxious middle-class families is simple. Buy a back door before the law changes. The truth is uglier. Citizenship should be the foundation of civic life, not a product to be hoarded. When nationality becomes another asset class, the social contract erodes. The wealthy buy exits. The rest of us inherit the consequences. The market will keep selling escape routes until there's nothing left to sell but the idea that belonging can be bought.